one thing that I would say is, like, when you're building vertical apartment complexes, you typically have to build the entire thing and then start renting. And in order to make it so that it's not vacant anymore, you have to give away concessions, and that's a problem. You have to wait a couple of years in order for it to stabilize.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Ruben Grath is a fund manager, podcast host, and build-to-rent subdivision developer. Ruben, welcome to the show.
Thanks, man. I'm so stoked to be here. Sam, man, I really appreciate you.
Hey, pleasure's mine, man. Three questions I ask every guest who comes to the show in 90 seconds or less. Can you tell me, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
So I started in mortgage, I guess selling mortgages. And then from there, learned a little bit about this thing called truth in lending. And really what I learned from that is how to capital raise without asking for money, and also how to not promise any guaranteed money. So I moved into joint venture capital raising back during the real estate crash, eventually moved into syndication, heavy lift multifamily syndication with a local mom and pop operator here. Then started my show, the Capital Raiser Show, learned about these capital raisers, their strategies, and I met all these sponsors. And then the lawyers told me, if you want to make money putting these guys together, you need to start your own fund. So I left to go launch my own fund. When Andy McMullen, my partner at Legacy Acquisitions, approached me and said, hey, let's get into the build-to-rent space and then raise capital for these other multifamily sponsors using fund structure so that we can legally stay compliant. And now I'm a partner in his company and Legacy Acquisitions, and that's essentially what we do. We build out subdivisions, and then sometimes we raise capital for select sponsors in the space, in the multifamily value add space.
It's a lot of moving parts. So yeah, just to make sure I understand that, where you guys are now, you're developing subdivisions, and then also when the opportunity and deal makes a heck of a lot of sense, you'll take your fund and you'll say, okay, we're going to deploy capital into your opportunity as well.
Yeah, typically it's more about the operator and how we feel about them versus the deal.
Sure.
So it's not about the market. It's not about the deal. It's about our relationship with existing operators. And yeah, so we have two divisions of our business. One where we raise capital for other sponsors in fund structures or co-GP structures. And then the other part is we build out subdivisions and raise capital for our own deals that way.
Right, right. Let's talk about that. We'll kind of tackle both of those in succession there. Fund versus co-GP. How do you guys select which way you're taking it down? What are the differences and why?
So a co-GP structure requires some kind of an ongoing duty in order for you to stay legally compliant. Typically, that's either asset management or marketing or investor relations, underwriting of the deal and market analysis and stuff like that. So we have to have a board of advisory kind of position where we're constantly participating in the decision-making and the operations of a deal versus a fund. It's quite the opposite, right? So a fund, you're your own security, you raise money in the fund, you deploy a check as a limited partner into somebody else's deal, and you're essentially not obligated to do anything. Maybe participate in board of advisory, but you're managing your own security, right? So you got to do investor relations, you got to underwrite deals, you got to do marketing, and then you got to do the operations of your own fund. But as far as operations of the deal go, it's completely hands off, because technically as the limited partner, you don't participate in the decisions, right? So, but then the question becomes, well, how do you pay for your fund? When does it make sense? Well, there has to be different tiers of money, or I should say interest and returns that you get as a fund. That's got to be above and beyond what a 50,000 retail investor makes, right? So sometimes the fund makes money because it gets advanced economics, like a better return structure. Sometimes the money, I should say the fund, gets paid because they participate in acquisition fees or other kind of structures like that. And every time it's different, right? So every sponsor, even some sponsors will allow you to do both. You can either co-GP or you can do a fund. It just depends. You're always wanting to make your investors the greatest amount of money. And you're always probing with your sponsors, hey, what is that form? And in some cases, it's a co-GP structure, and in some cases, it's a fund structure.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's been one of the challenges that the fund structure has had, is that it does or could potentially dilute investor returns. So like you said, finding a way to get a side letter agreement with your deal sponsor, if you do want to participate in acquisition fees, or if it is, like you said, a, what do you call it, advanced economics. That's a nice way of, so I really love that you said it's an iterative process, it sounds like, for you guys, in that each person you work with, it might be a slightly different arrangement, but yet it's something that, you know, you just figured out on the fly.
Even with the same sponsor from deal to deal, the agreement can change. But yeah, like you mentioned, the side letter agreement, which is extremely important. When somebody comes and approaches us and says, we'd love to have you participate in our capital raise, we have a few weeks left to raise for XYZ deal. At that point, it's too late because there's no side letter agreement in place typically. And it takes us time to build our own entity, create that structure, deal with our lawyer, probe our investors to make sure that they like the market and the sponsor. So at that point, it's way beyond too late.
Right.
Right. So you have to have the relationship in place with the side letter, understanding what you're going to get before the deal is even coming down the pipeline, honestly. So you need a great deal of time to raise in a fund, to make sure that your investors have an appetite for whatever it is that you're investing in.
Right. No, that's great. Let's talk about the build to rent side of things. I'm sure you're busy, but before we get into that, define the difference between, say, vertical multifamily and horizontal multifamily.
Okay. So vertical multifamily typically is like a garden style four-story building or something that's built units on top of units on top of units with no backyard, no personal driveway, no space of your own, right? You're sharing that space with other people that are above and below you in a lot of cases. Whereas build to rent, at least the way that we approach it and look at it, is it's horizontal multifamily, meaning it's detached multifamily units, or better even said, is houses, like a full-blown house with a backyard and a doggy door and a driveway and in some cases technology. And we build these things out all in one subdivision, so that all of your units in one place, so you can operate it the same way that a multifamily is operated, where a property manager can be on site in some cases, or at least have the general vicinity all in one place. And people love that because they want to buy houses. I should say institutions and really big buyers, they want to have like 100 or 1,000 or 8,000 houses, but they can't have them spread out in different counties. You can't property manage it effectively that way. So there's a big appetite from institutions and REITs and all these other huge buyers that are looking for these mom and pop operators that are building about 100 to 300 units at a time. And then here's the other thing too. It's like you can do build to rent in certain markets and it's going to be a lot easier and faster, like a sub-market or a secondary market, better said, in Louisiana, which is where we're building, and in Alabama. The cities want to help you get across the finish line quickly because they need affordable housing and they're in growth stage. Whereas if you go to a city like Phoenix, Dallas, Atlanta, there's all this red tape. It may take 2 or 3 years before you can even entitle the land, right? So our investors were wanting their money pretty quickly. So in these bigger markets, unless you're very well integrated into that market and have a track record and have figured out ways to move quicker because you have a ton of private equity or private money from these big institutional players, you're probably going to go through the process a lot slower. So in those cases, maybe build to rent looks like, hey, I'm going to buy a 2-acre piece of land and build 5 townhome buildings, right? 4 units each or something like that. It's a lot faster to get through the red tape in a big city doing something like that. Whereas if you're trying to build a subdivision of 200 or 300 houses in Phoenix, man, you better be able to wait because it takes a long time to get across the finish line.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. You mentioned Louisiana and Alabama. I mean, what are the size of neighborhoods you're buying or building, I should say? And talk to us about the financing as it pertains to that. I mean, it's like a construction loan, but it just keeps going on. I would imagine it's got to be a really interesting kind of way that the financing works.
It's the biggest headache, the financing part, when you compare it to multifamily value add syndication, right? Because there's moving parts, there's supply chain issues that are changing, lumber cost, and your lender's constantly looking at like, what's the cost for the next 10 units that you're going to build? And if it changes from 10 units to 10 units, well, guess what? All of a sudden, the reserves change, the interest rates change. So it's a little bit trickier and it's kind of more of a moving animal versus, you know, it'd be great if some bank, some community or regional bank was just like, here's like a huge check that you can take out in draws, but it's a guaranteed interest rate for the duration of your construction. That would be like the ideal scenario. Some places will do that and some places won't. And then it's based off of your market, your track record, and your relationships, right? So like, where are you building? Are you building right on the coast where hurricanes are landing and we have to worry about insurance issues and tornadoes and hurricanes and cyclones and all that stuff? Or are you building in a place where it's a little bit safer, where there's not going to be any flooding? Those things kind of taken into account. So you asked about the size of these developments. The first one that we're doing is a little bit over 11 acres, maybe just shy of 12. We're building 98, what they refer to as cottages, but they're like little mini tank houses, all cookie cutter with the exact same floor plan that are built with cement board. So they're designed for hurricanes, right? So The only thing that you're going to deal with is possibly a few shingles being blown by a heavy wind. They're elevated, so you're not worried. You're not in a flood zone, but you still have to do, in this particular market, these things called retention ponds. So if there's a 100-year storm, like the water has somewhere to drain within that subdivision.
Right.
But other than that, maybe like the worst thing that could happen is a fence gets blown down. Nothing too crazy. But the big deal for the residents is like, if there's a big storm that comes through, how long is it going to take before my power comes on? Or is the food in my refrigerator going to survive? Are the fish that get circulating air in my aquarium, are they going to die because we don't have electricity for 36 to 48 hours or whatever long it takes? So those are kind of the things. This next project is 18 acres that we're going to be doing. It's a 506C. All the stuff that we do is 506C. Typically in the build to rents, but this next one's going to be a unit mix of two bedroom houses, 3-bedroom and 4-bedroom. And then there's going to be a couple of attached townhome complexes, like 3 units. And the whole thing, I think if we ever try to sell it out individually, would have to be like condo converted. So we'll probably sell the entire community off, not subdivided, but like this one that we're doing in Louisiana, is each house is subdivided. So we have the opportunity, if we need to or want to, sell them off as houses or chunks of house, like 10 at a time. But ideally what we want to do is just sell the entire subdivision off to one particular buyer.
Yeah. And that was the next question, is what's the end game? And it sounds like that's it. You're going to build these, get them stabilized, and then move them off to an institutional buyer. Is that right?
Yeah. And you asked about the differences between horizontal and vertical. And one thing that I would say is like, when you're building vertical apartment complexes, you typically have to build the entire thing and then start renting. And in order to make it so that it's not vacant anymore, you have to give away concessions, and that's a problem. You have to wait a couple of years in order for it to stabilize. The thing that's different about horizontal is if you're building 10 or 20 at a time, you're leasing them up as they're being built. So if you've built 50, you know, by the time you get to 60, 40 of them are already rented out. And then when you get to like 100, you don't have to give away concessions to rent it. The whole community is almost already rented, typically in the markets where we are developing.
Yeah, that's a brilliant point, and not something I would have thought about, is that it's a stabilize as you build approach. And that's a really compelling reason to go down that route. Is there a density per acre that I may be asking the wrong term here. So what I'm thinking of is like on a vertical multifamily, there may be, I don't know, again, I don't know the right numbers here, but is there see if you can help clarify the question, density per acre difference in horizontal versus vertical multifamily?
So you're talking about zoning delineations and like how much density in a specific area you're allowed to build, right? So For example, in our Foley, Alabama project that we're going to be doing in about a month, in May of 2022, or maybe June of 2022, we have a piece of land, 18 acres, that allows for 180 units, 180 houses that are set, but we're only going to build 150. And part of that is to allow for walkways, places where people can run and have doggy parks and have amenities and things of that nature. It's going to increase the value to the point where we believe it's more effective to build bigger units versus that, which we can rent out for longer. And by the way, when a renter comes into a house versus a apartment, they tend to stay for 40 months versus the average apartment renter might be there for 18 months. So that's another reason you really like the stability and long-term mindset of the renter in there, or the resident, as we call them. And then the other factor about that is, well, I mean, that's it in a nutshell.
Right. Okay. What's the square footage build to rent? Are they typically smaller? I'm just thinking on a typical home compared to a typical apartment. Mm-hmm. Apartments are typically smaller. Is the build for rent houses, is that footprint smaller?
That's a pretty loaded question, because it just depends on what you're trying to do. I know in Phoenix, the build to rent developers here are building like 2,000 square foot houses. What we're doing in Louisiana is a 1,200 foot little cottage, right? So it's a 2-bedroom, 3-bath. It's got some extra closet space and a living room, but it's nothing too grand other than maybe a little bit of technology implemented. It's pretty basic little cottage style home. Mm-hmm. And we like that. On this next project, we're going to be doing similar floor plans, but we're going to be integrating a couple of unit mixes, right? Where they're 2-bedroom, 3-bedroom, or 4-bedroom or townhome style. But essentially, they're all going to be very cookie cutter when you compare them to each other. And they will look very similar on the inside, even though the elevation or exterior may be a little bit slightly different on the outside.
Right. That's cool. I love the thoughts around that. And really, I mean, in that space, there's, I would think the only competition is really speed to market. And
that's a big part. Like, how fast can you build these? How fast can you get your investor money back? So one of the things that we do to increase that speed is we entitle the property. Like, we buy the property or either that or put it under contract and entitle it and have it ready to go so we can stick the shovel in the ground right when the capital raise begins. So we're not raising money and then entitling and then dealing with city civil engineering and city red tape and everything else. Like, we're already like way along the way by the time that we start raising for these deals. That's, you know, typically we do them in syndications, but at some point we're hoping to attach a, you know, project or two to a fund model and say, hey, we're just going to do this over and over in this fund. And at some point we're going to get there. But right now we're running these as syndications.
Right. Yeah. And I guess that's a question. And it doesn't sound like you've gone full cycle on an entire neighborhood yet.
No, we're barely building our first one, right? So we have our first eight units on it's called the Creston, Colorado. It's in Lafayette, Louisiana. And then we're about to we're going through the entitlement process and the city department has approved our plans, our architectural plans for this next one. And it's in an area of the country where they're starting to put in moratoriums. So we've already been approved. That makes it exciting for us because they're not going to allow a bunch of developers to come in here. So we're going to have exclusivity at some degree. But yeah, that's kind of where we're at there.
Right. So Ruben, tell me, I guess on the investor side of things, because these get built, they get rented. Walk me through, because I don't know, from my perspective, modeling that out and then modeling returns to investors would be very unique or different compared to, say, a multifamily project we buy. Here's the value add plan. Here's how we're going to rents change. Then we're done. I mean, is there some nuance to this and how you underwrite and then how you plan for distributions to your investors?
Well, there is definitely. I wish I could say that I do the underwriting, the civil engineering, the construction management, but I only have one part that I really focus in on, which is creating relationships with investors. And raising capital and bringing capital raisers to become part owners of our funds. And there's definitely something to what you just said. Like, how do you underwrite this versus a multifamily syndication?
Right.
And like I think some of the moving pieces that you would add is like, you're projecting what are development costs along the way, right? And then you get hit with a new charge that the city is wanting in order for you to create something. Or they say, in order for you to make this happen, you have to add this to the property. And you're trying to calculate that as best as you can. And the other part that we mentioned earlier is, what's the loan product, right? So you're not dealing with the stabilized bridge loan that you know exactly, even though that's less of a product that you want to keep long term. Maybe it actually is not a bad situation for some multifamily syndicators in this market with the way that the economic climate in terms of interest rates is changing. But you have this moving animal where the bank is constantly re-underwriting you
right
as you are going. So the investors get a little frustrated in comparison to multifamily syndication, where they know what the loan product is. They know exactly what it's going to be throughout the duration of the first 3 years. And then maybe they don't know what the refinance is or what the next loan product is. But with us, it's constantly changing for every 10 units that we're building, unless we find a very specialized, sophisticated debt fund or building, housing, development, kind of loan construction, private equity firm that's already on board with the whole idea of build to rent. But they're typically harder to find than most regular agency debt lenders or banks that you may deal with.
Right. Talk to me real quick here. Last question before we jump off. Talk to me about the investor experience. When does an investor in your models, when do they get paid? How does that work? Because again, it's just a very different thing. So really,
you're attempting to calculate at what occupancy are you breaking even? And what if that number is like 40, 50 or 60%?
Right.
So once you get to 60% of the houses built and rented, even though the entire project may be not completed, you can start collecting cash flow and then start doing distributions to your investors. But the other thing that we typically like is that we're building these things out. Our construction team is very quickly. So we can build a group of 10 houses every month. So we can build an entire subdivision in around 12 months.
Right.
Possibly we would underwrite it and say, just in case of four unforeseen circumstances, we're going to say that we're going to build this thing out in 18 months and sell it out in 30 months or something like that. But the reality is we can have these things completely built out and rented in about 18 months. And at that point, you can potentially sell it. It may take you a few months, but you can beat the projection, a five-year projection. And in this space, you can typically get a 2x equity multiple, which means you can double your LP, your limited partner money in about 30 months or however long it takes you to stabilize and sell the project, which once again, we're being very conservative because we believe that we can build these in about 10 months. We're projecting 18 months just in case anything crazy happens. But in reality, we're selling, hey, we can double your money in about 30, 36 months. But the reality is we have these things stabilized and going in about 24, if not much less.
That's awesome. I love it. Ruben, thank you for taking the time today to break down your business, how you guys are raising capital, where you see opportunity in the market, and what you guys are doing to take these deals down. I certainly love it. And thanks for breaking down kind of that build to rent model. That's not something we've talked about a lot here on the show. And I love the way you guys are doing it. So thanks again for taking the time to come on today. If our listeners want to get in touch with you or learn more about you, what is the best way to do that?
So check out the show at capitalraisershow.com or check out our opportunities and my business, my construction and development and capital raising fund management business at legacyacquisitions.com, or just find me on LinkedIn.
Awesome. We'll certainly include all of those links. Thank you again for your time today, Ruben. Appreciate it.
Thanks, brother. This has been a blast.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.